There's a culture war going on in this country. We can no longer remain silent on the issues that affect us all. Decisions we make now will determine our future. But how do we engage with the culture in a way that honors Jesus? How do we rise above the noise to know what is right and what is true? It's time to bring God back into the conversation. It's time to reconnect. Here's Carmen.
Welcome, friends. I'm Carmen LaBurge. This is The Reconnect. We're here to speak the truth on the real issues of the day in real time. So how do we do that? How do we get God back into the conversations of the day? How do we enter into those conversations as the ambassadors of Jesus Christ? And how do we speak the mind of Christ on the matters of the day? Let's face it, people don't need just another piece of our mind, but they very much need the peace of the mind of Christ. So how do we give that to them? We have resources posted for you at reconnectwithcarmen.com. While you're there, you can sign up for our email newsletter. You'll get lots of information and commentary we just don't have time to share here in this hour on the air. You can also like The Reconnect on Facebook. You can always let me know what you're thinking about on Twitter. I'm at Carmen LaBurge. If you go to the website today at reconnectwithcarmen.com, you can get a free downloadable chapter from my forthcoming book. The release is a week from today, so you still got time to pre-order a copy. The title is Speak the Truth, How to Bring God Back into Every Conversation. Obviously a theme and subject matter you are familiar with. So I flesh that out for you. I give you some how-tos. I try to reconnect the eternal with the everyday in ways that you can literally take into the conversations that you are having around the water cooler and everywhere else. And actually, today's Below the Fold is a very specific response from one friend on social media in relationship to a story that we talked about here on The Reconnect, and then she followed up, and I've got some follow-up for you in the Below the Fold portion of the show today. But let me start off the show with this. So there's a new index out there in America. It's called the American Fear Index. So I'm going to start with this because the Fear Index, the new American Fear Index launched by the Cato Institute, it is aggregating information from the media where certain words appear in the press and in the media, and then how people are responding to those particular words. So in another conversation, we might call these triggers. And so how is it that I can trigger a fear response in you? And the article at Cato at Liberty actually notes that we're actually pretty good at this. We're actually pretty good propagandists and zealots, that is, as the article notes. Also, you might think of preachers. We're pretty good at triggering a fear response. We actually know what makes people afraid and what people are afraid of. And so what they have done in this American Fear Index is try to gauge just how worried or anxious people are today compared with other times in history. And the article says, as it turns out, the answer is quite a bit more worried or quite a bit more anxious. So the index, it says here, is an attempt to improve our understanding of fear and its role in American politics by tracking the level of fear in our public discourse about the nation, the world, and the challenges we face. So if you just gave that some thought for a moment and you said to yourself, well, what am I afraid of and what are the people around me afraid of? You might come up with an interesting list. They actually look down a list of everything from war to cancer to it's quite a long list. To terrorism, to specific things like North Korea, to murder, to robots, to fascism, to racism, to places around the globe and organizations like Al-Qaeda, everything down to biology and airplanes. So just so you know, people in the United States actually have less fear of nuclear war than they do of biology and airplanes. So, and actually the racism actually comes in relatively low on the percentage of news stories that contain an issue or a term that is considered fear-based or fear-promoting. So why bring this up? Well, I bring this up because people are filled with fear. They do have anxiety. They do worry. Death, or better said, dying, actually remains one of the greatest of our fears. But dealing with death and dealing with the process of dying is actually only a problem if we're people who haven't made our peace with God, if we're actually failing to live in accordance with the reality of God and therefore the reality of who we are, and in accordance with God's redemptive plan unfolding in the context of human history, specifically through the gospel, which we know through Jesus Christ. So let me juxtapose the public witness of two men, two very prominent public people. One is Jim Carrey, and the other is Nabil Qureshi. Now, those two names, one of them may mean more to you than another, depending on what sphere of influence you spend a lot of time in. My guess is the name Jim Carrey is one you are familiar with. Jim Carrey is certainly a culture maker. He is a comedian. He is a movie star. He's an influencer of millions. He's also a man living in very public distress. I don't have another way of saying it. He is facing a wrongful death lawsuit related to the suicide of his girlfriend in September of 2015. In 2013, she penned a series of suicide notes blaming Jim Carrey for giving her STDs and a number of other very negative things about him, leading to her desire to kill herself. She, at that point in time, did not act on those thoughts or ideas, but in 2015, just 2 years ago in September, she took her own life. If you have been paying attention at all to what Jim Carrey is up to and what he sounds like these days, the only way that I can describe it is he's attempting what's known in philosophy as erasure or self-erasure, saying that he does in fact not exist. And yet he is standing there full of flesh and covered with flesh and full of blood, and a person nonetheless, and yet denying his own existence. So he is trying to either, here are my two theories, he's either trying to build the basis for an insanity defense, or the defense that Jim Carrey can't be held accountable if, in fact, Jim Carrey, as he contends, never existed. It could be the most brilliant move of all times, and it could be that the guy is just honestly out of his mind. Two recent interviews is what I would use to reveal sort of this to you. One is an interview that took place at New York's Fashion Week, and it ignited the current media responses. So these are some of the things he said in that interview. He said, "I don't believe in icons. I don't believe in personalities. I believe that peace lies beyond personality, because beyond the skies, because the red X you wear upon your chest, well, that has no meaning." He says, "I didn't get dressed up. There is no me. There is just things happening. They're clusters of tetrahedrons moving around together." That's how he describes people. He says, "It's not our world. That's the key. We don't matter." He's describing his own sense of nihilism, that he doesn't matter, that people don't matter, that personhood doesn't matter, as quote-unquote the good news. In a subsequent interview, he said, "I think we're all trying to add things to ourselves so we can finally define ourselves." And then he talks about the non-existence of the reality which is standing right in front of you, which is another human being. He says, "Life is a giant field of consciousness. You," pointing at the interviewer, "don't have a soul. There is a soul, and it includes everything. But when you wake up in the morning and feel like I am the universe, you don't have to reach for the stars. You're already there. There is no me," he says, "no self. There is no Jim Carrey. There never was." Friends, worldview matters. And if you needed evidence that it's possible to gain the whole world and lose your soul, Jim Carrey is giving you just that. His impersonal view of the universe, devoid of God, is therefore devoid of meaning and purpose. He imagines a freedom and a joy, but in his own words, you can hear his utter bondage, his utter despair. Now let me juxtapose that with the story of another man. His name is Nabil Qureshi. Nabil Qureshi was 34 years old when he died this past Saturday. It is notable that he died at the same age as our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ. It's also notable that Nabil was born in California as a U.S. citizen to Pakistani immigrants who fled religious persecution at the hands of fellow Muslims. His parents were devout members of a very peaceful sect of Islam. He was raised in a traditional Islamic home. His family, even he described as the most loving and tightly knit family he ever knew, entirely centered on Islam, which formed the framework and blueprint of his life. His parents also trained him in apologetics so that he would not only believe in Islam, but be able to defend it and refute other religions like Christianity. Well, as the Lord would have it, Nabil intersected and interacted with ambassadors of Jesus Christ, people who understood who Christ is and shared the love of Christ and the gospel of Christ with Nabil. And over the course of time, through his own inquiry, through deep study and exploration of reality and scrutiny of his own faith, Nabil received Jesus Christ as his Lord and Savior. He basically said, "You know, I could do no other. Once I got to the point where I realized who Jesus is and what he has done, I could do no other." Nabil went on to study Christian apologetics at Biola University, graduating with an MA in 2008, completing his medical degree at Eastern Virginia Medical School in 2009. In 2012, he completed an MA in religion at Duke. Then he entered a Master's of Philosophy and PhD program at Oxford in New Testament Studies. And in 2013, he became an itinerant speaker with the Ravi Zacharias International Ministry. So you would recognize his name as the author of Seeking Allah, Finding Jesus, Answering Jihad, A Better Way Forward, and No God But One, Allah or Jesus, A Former Muslim Investigates the Evidence for Islam and Christianity. It was upon the release date of that last book, No God But One, in August of 2016, that on his Facebook page, on the date of the release of the book, Nabil Qureshi this. He announced that he had been diagnosed with advanced stomach cancer. And now, just 1 year later, he is gone. But he died not a martyr, and he died not a victim. He died a joyful son of the living God in the full knowledge of the grace of Jesus Christ, our Savior and our Lord. He died with a personal understanding of the universe and his purpose in it. He died having lived sacrificially. This is a man who literally lived out Romans chapter 12 in terms of offering his life as a living sacrifice, holy and acceptable to God, as an act of spiritual worship. He is dead, but for him we do not despair. Instead, along with Ravi Zacharias, who is his mentor and friend and colleague in ministry, we grieve for a world that is broken and lost. Ravi ends his piece that's posted today in the Washington Post this way. I mourn for our broken world, where so much hate and destruction abounds. We have a cancer called sin. That disease kills the disease that kills the body is minor, but the disease that kills the soul is eternal. Nabil would want more than anything else that we carry the message of Jesus to help change the world. Only then can we understand that the sad news of Nabil's death is only temporary. Friends, you and I have the opportunity today to be ambassadors of Jesus Christ in the midst of the world that he so loves. Let us offer ourselves as living sacrifices today that others might come to know the good news of the gospel. All right, friends, I'm going to make a transition here to a conversation about Constitution Day. Today is the day we celebrate Constitution Day. Now, I'm not saying, you know, that you and I maybe have a good constitution or not a good constitution. If we're Americans, we have a great constitution. And so that's what we're going to talk about. We're going to talk about the Constitution of the United States of America. And we're going to be joined in this conversation by Jonathan Crumley. Jonathan is a lawyer at Taylor English in Atlanta, Georgia. He also serves with ministries that help people in the area of First Amendment law. And so I thought it would be fun to have a conversation today with Jonathan about Constitution Day. So Jonathan, welcome to the Reconnect.
Thank you. Appreciate you inviting me, Carmen.
All right. So this is your Constitution quiz. I hope you're ready to pass a quiz on the Constitution. The preamble of the Constitution of the United States says what?
The preamble says that in order to create a more perfect union,
All right, so now you make me feel better. You make me feel better because, okay, so I think that that's a tough quiz. Easier one because it is a tough quiz. It's a tough quiz. Okay, so when the general population was asked about what they knew about the Constitution of the United States, it would not surprise either one of us that people could not recite the preamble. But
correct.
Would it surprise you that most people either could only name one in four of the three branches of government, or 33% of the people in America couldn't name even one branch of government? Tell us what the branches of government are and where they are laid out for us in the Constitution.
That one's a little easier. That would be the legislative branch, the executive branch, and then the judicial branch. And the legislative branch is Article 1, which is based on the founders' belief that the legislature was actually the preeminent body to create law. Article 2 is the executive, and Article 3 is the judiciary.
All right. And the Constitution, really, when you think about what it has done for us and what it accomplishes in terms of creating of us a people and organizing us, it's really not all that long. There's only 7 articles, right?
Correct. And one of
all right, but it's not. Go ahead.
One of them is devoted to how do we amend the document. So it's really not that in terms of the substantive rights that are ensconced in it, that doesn't go to that.
Okay, I love that. Okay, so you've taken us to the amendment conversation, because I do think that the part of the Constitution that most people are familiar with, or at least some part of the amendments is what they're familiar with, people recognize that maybe we have equal protection under the law, and that's really based on an amendment, not really based on one of the original articles. And how about the First Amendment? When you think of the First Amendment of the Constitution, what do you think of in terms of the scope of what's covered there?
It's actually one of, as you might suspect, my favorite amendments. It lays out actually all of our first liberties, the first of which is freedom of religion. There are actually 5 liberties described and protected in the First Amendment, and for the longest time, most of our fellow citizens have a trouble identifying anything other than freedom of the press in the First Amendment.
All right, but you and I are looking at some current research right now from the Annenberg public policy folks, and we have some disturbing statistics here related to people's knowledge or understanding of the First Amendment. 37% could not name a single right protected in the First Amendment. What does that tell you about where we're at in terms of our civics education?
That is pretty abysmal. And if you think about that level of sort of lack of knowledge of one of our founding documents, really, it's the charter that is supposed to control the scope and the size of federal government. It's not surprising. If you look at the landscape of the rights that we just sort of freely and willingly give up based on sort of majority rule, as opposed to the true concept of natural rights, which are that, you know, even if the majority of the population thinks we ought to curtail things like free exercise of religion, the founders believed, and that it was in both the Declaration of Independence and in the First Amendment, that no, it's not majority rule, it's not the tyranny of the majority. There are certain rights and liberties that ought to trump the popular will of the people at the time.
Okay, so trumping the popular will of the people is one of the conversations that we're probably having in some pockets across the country, you know, where we talk about the Electoral College, which is established in the Constitution, versus just an absolute pure democratic vote where the majority, you know, a pure majority elects the president. So what you're saying is that there's sometimes we're sort of need to be protected from ourselves in terms of what the majority thinks or believes. Is that a fair interpretation?
Absolutely. It's a quote that I've seen attributed to Franklin, Benjamin Franklin. I'm not sure if it's him or not, but the democracy is essentially 2 wolves and a lamb voting over what's for dinner. And our founders believe that entirely, that democracy was, in fact, a dangerous thing. And they created all kinds of checks and balances within the Constitution that would slow the march of most humans into our belief that, well, hey, if it's popular or if all of my neighbors think this is the way it ought to be, then that's what government should do. For example, the Electoral College is, you know, come into disrepute when certain voting bloc in America, ironically, only after somebody broke through the Great Blue Wall in the Midwest. But the fact is, the Electoral College was specifically intended to protect the interests of the less populated states. That without the Electoral College, essentially, New York, California, and Texas would be the only states that control the presidency.
All right, so we're talking with Jonathan Crumley on this Constitution Day, and Jonathan, I'm going to let you appeal to the people who are listening for a renewed interest in study of and devotion to the Constitution of the United States of America. Make an appeal.
There are so many issues today, no matter which side of the aisle you're on, whether you're pro-Trump, anti-Trump, pro-Republican, anti-Republican, pro-progressive, anti-liberty, whatever you want to call it, the biggest issue we're facing is a huge conflict within the area of freedom of conscience, which is, of the First Amendment, that is really where you find the most protection. And the ironic thing and about the whole election of Trump is that now I think my colleagues and friends that are more on the liberal progressive side of thinking are realizing that freedom of conscience is in fact something you want to restrict the government on. You know, for the last 10 to 12 years, we've been hearing this mantra of, you know, marriage equality. We had the Obergefell decision, but nobody thought through, well, what happens to those folks that are the cake bakers and the wedding photographers and the florists that have a very sincerely held religious belief that that is a sacrament of God and not a civil ceremony? Should they and could they be compelled to use their artistic talents to participate in that ceremony? Well, up until Trump was elected, you know, folks like me would be laughed out of legal circles because, oh, clearly that's just discrimination. They have to do it. Well, now you just look at the headlines. How many dress designers are refusing to design dresses for Melania Trump because they don't like her politics? Well, they're able to make that decision because they have the freedom of conscience. It's the same freedom that we all, under both the Declaration and the Constitution, that's what we mean by inalienable rights. We as human beings created in the image of God are endowed by God with certain rights that we can't give away. And we ought not to have a government that looks to limit without a very, very good reason.
Absolutely. All right, friends, we're going to conclude our conversation with Jonathan Crumley, and we want to thank you for being with us today on the Reconnect on this Constitution Day. I'm going to conclude, now don't worry, I have it actually pulled up on the internet, with the preamble of the Constitution, which says, "We the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty." Now, that's what we've been talking about, those blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity. Do ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America. Jonathan Crumley, thanks for celebrating this Constitution Day with us. We'll be committed with you to the extension of liberty, not only here in the United States, but to others. Thank you, my friend.
Thanks for the time.
All right, folks, I am going to encourage you to reread the Constitution of the United States today. All of it. First of all, it's not that long. All right. So you heard the preamble. It's not even a really long sentence by comparison to like Paul's writings in the New Testament. And then it's only got seven articles and they each lay out really important sort of foundational pieces of what it means and what it's going to look like to be we the people. And then, of course, we have the 27 amendments to the Constitution, and we've talked about the First Amendment, but you would know the first 10 as the Bill of Rights. And then the 14th Amendment is one that you probably know. The 25th Amendment is probably one that you have heard discussed of late. And so I would commend to you a reading of the Constitution of the United States, easy to find on this Constitution Day. All right, friends, when we come back, we are going to be talking with Ben Stewart. Ben Stewart is the pastor of a brand new Passion City Church plant in Washington, D.C. And so prior to joining Passion City Church, which we talked with him just before he was actually going to Passion in Atlanta. But prior to that, he served for 11 years as the executive director of Breakaway Ministries, which is a weekly Bible study attended by thousands of college students on the campus of Texas A&M University. And so we want to talk with Ben about his brand new book, Single, Dating, Engaged, Married. I commend this conversation to you because no matter where you're at in life, you're in one of those stages of relationship. All right, friends, this is The Reconnect. It is a listener-supported ministry. It's also a ministry that's supported by folks across the country who believe that God should be back in the conversations of the day, and that in order to do that, his people need to be mobilized and equipped to enter into the conversations of the day in ways that honor Jesus. If you want to participate with us in this ministry, go to reconnectwithcarmen.com and hit the donate button. We'd love to have you on board with us. All right, friends, this is The Reconnect. Connect with me at reconnectwithcarmen.com. I'll be right back. Hey, friends. I'm Carmen LaBurge, and this is The Reconnect. Indeed, we worship a God who is the God of hills and valleys. He's also the God of our singleness and our dating life and our marriedness and our engagement and everything else. So wherever you are in the relational, navigational thing, God is in the midst of it at every point. God is a relational God, and God is interested in you having healthy relationships with others. Hey, this is The Reconnect. We're here. Well, we're trying to put God in his place, back where he belongs, in the middle of every conversation. And so we talk about what people are talking about. And most of the time, people are talking about each other. And so we're going to talk today about relationships. My conversation partner for this is the pastor of the brand new Passion City Church in Washington, D.C. His name is Ben Stewart. He's been a guest here on the program before. The last time we talked with him, he was headed to Atlanta. He didn't know where he was going to go after that. And the Lord has now revealed and led Ben and his wife to Washington, D.C., where they are planting the newest Passion City Church. Prior to going to Passion City, Ben served for 11 years as the executive director of Breakaway Ministries, a weekly Bible study that was attended by thousands of college students on the campus of Texas A&M University. He's here to talk with us today about his book, Single, Dating, Engaged, Married, Navigating Life and Love in the Modern Age. You can check the church out at PassionCityChurch.com. You can follow Ben on Twitter at Ben_Stewart, spelled the right way, Stuart underscore. So that's Ben_Stewart_. Hey, Ben, welcome to The Reconnect.
Hey, it's great to be here, Carmen. Thank you.
All right, so why this topic? Why the topic of navigating the stages of relationship?
Well, I would say two things. One is I've had the privilege of living the last decade plus among young people and just have a heart for them and love for them. And in that, I've just watched over the last 10 years as the culture has shifted in many key ways, I've seen that journey through those stages become increasingly difficult, tumultuous, stressful for people that I care about. And so I wrote the book really from a pastoral heart of trying to bring clarity to confusion and a guidebook to the uncertain waters of love. And so that's really why I did it, to try to bring some clarity where it seems like that's in a short supply.
So I know that there's no way that you are old enough to not only remember, but even be conceived in the summer of love, which was 1967.
Yeah, I wasn't there.
But okay, so there's a lot of people, you know, sort of looking back fondly or terrifyingly at that event 50 years ago, and you know that's the advent of the song "All We Need Is Love." It's sort of the elevation of certainly sexual relationships in this country as the one thing that you need to feel fulfilled and worthy and free. And yet that is not at all what we're talking about from a Christian worldview when we're talking about any of this, when we're talking about what it means to be a single Christian or a dating Christian or an engaged Christian or a married Christian. So talk with us about, you know, because you come out of this experience with college students, and man, that's just, for a lot of them, that's just where they're at. And discuss some of those things.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, deep within every human heart is the desire for belonging and mattering, to be a part of a community and be a part of a cause. I mean, those are deeply woven into every human heart. And the reality is God's given us both a communion with himself and with others, but he's given us a cause. I mean, you know, Colossians, God will say all things are made by God and for him. You know, Augustine said it, we're going to be restless until we find our rest in him. So when I look at young people that are single, they're trying to figure out what is my life about. And your life's not all about someone of the opposite sex or someone to fall in love with. That doesn't really work to put romance with another human at the pinnacle. In fact, that's going to be detrimental. You know, God says in 1 John, beloved, love one another, for love is from God. And what he's saying there is the only way you're going to love one another well is if you tap into that love relationship with God first. And you see it in singleness. You know, Paul will say it singleness is a gift in 1 Corinthians, and he'll say it is to secure an undistracted devotion to the Lord. That's what singleness is about. Every person on the planet is going to be single at some point, and God's wired it that way to give you an opportunity to be free of the encumbrances of marriage so you can be devoted to him. And so I've found when young people realize that, my life is about chasing God, and then romance is about finding someone that's chasing after him along with me too, that's when they find that cause and community linking up in a way that thrills the human heart. And that's a big passion of mine, is helping them see that pathway, that community is those who are running after this great cause together. And that's what I'd love to see in their heart. And those are the young people I see that are most alive in the culture today and aren't lost in the pool of just trying to find love somewhere.
Mm. Friends, we're having a conversation with Ben Stewart about his new book, Single Dating, Engaged, Married, Navigating Life and Love in the Modern Age. I just want to give a little shout out to whoever designed the cover of your book, because it's actually impossible to, like, you like look at it and you're like, oh, I'm a little bit dizzy, which I think is probably the point.
Yep.
I do think that for a lot of people, you know, we're talking about something that they want very, very much, which would be a fulfilling marriage, a lifelong marriage, a great marriage, a marriage that will last, a marriage that is more than just, you know, two people sharing space, but really, as you've described it, two people both pursuing God at an equal pace so that they can be genuinely equally yoked and on mission. So let's talk about that marriage and mission component, because I love the way you talk about that. So share that with people.
Yeah, well, thanks. Well, you know, Paul told young Timothy, flee youthful passion, pursue righteousness, faith, and love, along with those who call out to the Lord from a pure heart. And that's such a great picture. He's like, Timothy, you make the decision to run after God. And what will happen is those who want him as bad as you do will be running along with you. And that's really, I mean, you look in Genesis, the longest chapter in Genesis is Genesis chapter 24, and it's the one about marriage. I mean, it's longer than the creation chapter or the sin chapter is the marriage chapter. And Abraham's number one concern for his son is, you've got to get with a woman that knows God and is willing to live on the cutting edge of faith, just like you and I are. And so that's really the Bible's presentation of marriage. Marriage is not about staring into the eyes of another person to find your meaning. It is gripping hands with them and running with them into the purposes God has given you both. The wedding ceremony is a good picture of that. You gaze into each other's eyes for a minute, and then that pastor turns you towards the world, and you link hands and go charging out that back door into the world. And that's what a married couple is supposed to do. And the only healthy married couple we're shown in the New Testament did just that. And we are all beneficiaries of a Priscilla and Aquila that leveraged their marriage and home and business and life to help the Apostle Paul get rolling. And that's where marriage is most alive. You know, C.S. Lewis will say it, that friendship has to be about something. That's why the person who just wants friends won't have any. A friendship is formed when two people say, what, you too? And they both enjoy a thing together. And the best marriages I've seen are like that. It's two people who love the cause that they're on together. And when I talk to a lot of couples that are contemplating divorce, they say our lives are going in different directions. And you go, what do you mean by that? That doesn't mean, well, I'm a plumber and she's a librarian. They mean in the biggest issues in life, we are headed with different visions, and so we have different values, and then we make different decisions. But if you can get a united vision, we as a family are going to chase after that which our Maker has made for us to do. Man, that makes marriage fun. Now our marriage is on mission together, and it's an endless joy to be running together after the greatest of all causes.
Okay, so I have two more like real questions for you, and then I have just a totally selfish first time author question. So, okay, so you've been hosting these very cool Facebook Lives. You're gathering questions from people. What have you been observing about it? Just, are there trends in terms of what people are concerned about?
Yeah, well, you know, it's interesting. The questions I've got, and that's a great question, Carmen, is they've been all across the map because people are in so many different places. But I would say with young people, they're just so confused, a lot of them, on where to start. I mean, for all the flaws of the dating scripts in the past, at least there was kind of a path, you know? Like, well, there's the dance on Friday nights and we all get a date and go. But young people today really don't know, am I supposed to text somebody I'm interested in? Do I call them? Do I ask them to go on a date? Like, is that language antiquated? And a lot of the anxiety I encounter is just young people not even knowing how to connect with one another. And there's factors to that, but growing up with the technology we have, many people have seen it, it's interfered with basic social interactions for young people. And so much of ministry now for me has been coaching on socializing and being okay with, if you get rejected, you'll survive it and keep rolling. But many of them are just not as comfortable in how do I do this. And there's just this relief with a lot of young people when I tell them the statistical results, you know, that 80% of women would rather you ask them on a date and would rather you do it in person. Guys are like, okay, so they want me to walk. I'm like, yeah, man, go for it, bro. And they just need some basic coaching, and they want it, but they need some help.
All right, I love that. So everybody who's listening right now, you are certainly capable of doing the basic coaching that young people need. So don't be afraid to ask them what they're afraid of, and then don't be afraid to just give them the most basic of coaching in terms of social interaction. All right, so Ben, what are you hoping, above all, what are you hoping that somebody reading this book takes away?
Yeah, I think there's a great joy and there's a peace in your heart when you know what you're supposed to be doing in life. The people that I find feel so distressed are the ones that are like, I don't even know what I'm doing. And so my hope is that people, wherever they are on the relational seas, they would get the North Star in front of them. I live to know God. And now what are the implications of that for whatever stage I find myself in? And I hope that this book gives them the clarity that they could say, well, I'm single right now, or I'm dating, or I'm engaged, I'm married. How do I move through those seasons in a way that never loses sight of my great purpose of knowing God? And so if I can help them connect those dots between their love for God and how to navigate these very specific relational seasons, I know they'll feel joy, I know they'll feel peace, and that's what I want. I want all these conversations I've had with people about romance that are filled with anxiety and stress and sadness to start to turn over into joy and hope and trust. And if I can see that happen, that feels like a win.
I love that. All right, friends, you're listening to Ben Stewart. He's the author of Single, Dating, Engaged, Married, Navigating Life and Love in the Modern Age. He's also the pastor of Passion City Church's new church plant in Washington, D.C., which we're very excited about. You can check that out at passioncitychurch.com. All right, now here's my selfish first-time author question. So, so I have a book release a week from today.
Okay.
And what in the last week to make my book release as good as yours? Because, man, that was just pretty stellar.
It was crazy, wasn't it? Yeah. Yeah.
Totally crazy.
Surprise. Yeah.
All right. So just, congratulations. And we certainly took note of it here. We appreciate your coming on and sharing with us. A young person has come to mind as you've been talking that I'm going to have him connect with you at one of your Facebook Lives, because I just think that the tone and tenor with which you speak and lead, it's just so it's just exactly striking the right chord in terms of where young people are at today. So, Ben, thank you so much for the book. Thank you for writing it. And thank you for the ministry you do every day.
Wow. Thanks, Carmen. Well, it was fun to be here with you. Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks a lot. All right, friends, now I'm going to bring you up to date on something we have talked about here on the show a number of times, and it is it's probably the most heartbreaking and tragic conversations we ever have, and it is the conversation about suicide, particularly in relationship to young people. And so this is today's Below the Fold. This is the point in the show where we lift up stories and make connections that are designed to help you engage with others in conversations that they're already having, but they may be having without God as a part of it. And so what we're trying to do here is help you to speak the truth on the real issues of the day in real time. And so this real issue of the day in real time is the issue of suicide. And so just at the end of last week, actually this is dated September the 14th, so at the end of last week, Richard Blackwell posted on a kid, you know, on a family soccer website and also on the school website and on his own Facebook feed and on his LinkedIn profile, this devastating story about his 16-year-old daughter taking her own life. And there's nothing in here that, you know, that teenage ears can't hear. So don't worry, nothing graphic to share. I want you to be aware of the trauma that families are experiencing and also the resources that are available and the conversations that absolutely must be had. And so we have talked about this on a number of occasions here on the show. I just made a quick list during the break. I remember in August of 2016, we had Kay Warren on to talk about the death, the suicide of her son. In April, we talked about suicide and grief. In May, we talked with Sissy Goff about how we could respond to 13 Reasons Why. And just last week here on the show, we talked about grieving a suicide. What do believers who are members of the family of a suicide victim, how do we respond? How do we cope through that? What do we do? So that you could go grab those, the audio from those shows as well. Those dates are August 3rd, 2016, April 25th, 2017, May 1st, 2017, and then September 11th, 2017. And so this is an issue that we deal with because this is an issue that families are dealing with. And so just a couple of sentences from Richard Blackwell's post. I took this from his LinkedIn, the one posted on his LinkedIn, but it's a duplicate of what's posted on Facebook. He said, suicide had been something that Alex said she'd considered in the past, and we took it very seriously, but she was telling her therapist and she was telling us that she was past that now, and we were believing her. That's until he heard a pounding on the front door in the middle of the night. Took him a moment to wake up, he says. And when I got down to the door, there was a police officer there asking if I had a 16-year-old daughter, and if so, I needed to check on her. Suffice it to say that in their own home, under his own roof, his daughter took a combination of pills from which she did not wake up. He goes on to talk about what the ministry of presence of those who come and just simply sit with you, people who show up. And it was a good reminder to me in reading this, just to remind people, you don't have to say something. There is nothing to say. This is not the time to be giving any kind of platitudes. This is simply the time to go and sit with people as they are grieving in the deepest of places. And so just remind you of the ministry of presence. And then he has a list of things that he just wants to just come right out and say quite directly to parents. Number one, if love could not save her, what could? And then he says, I think in my heart, Alex made a decision on one bad day, one impulsive decision that couldn't be taken back. And so I think we do need to remember and recall take note of the fact that although people make plans to do this, at some point there's a moment where they make a decision to do it. And so if we can be as present as possible, but then also be mindful that this is a decision of an individual that they are making. And then some counsel in here that I think is really important. He says, girls can be very mean to each other. We can't just talk about bullies. We parents must ensure that our kid shares warmth, not hate, to those they don't like. And then he says 13 reasons why. It's great if you're not contemplating ending your life. For those in danger, it glorifies suicide and makes it seem not so hard to do. And then he says, if you're the editor of 13 Reasons Why, reach out to me. That's a pretty strong challenge, I would say, to the folks over at Netflix. Okay, we dealt with the issue of 13 Reasons Why in a conversation with Sissy Golf. We posted a resource related to it on our website at reconnectwithcarmen.com. I highly recommend that not only you yourself become equipped, but you need to share that with teachers, you need to share it with coaches, and you need to certainly share it with your teenage kids. And so I lift this up to you today in part because of a Facebook message I got from a friend named Gina. She said, Carmen, I just found the story that you shared about the teenager Alex. She actually was a member of my cousin's church. And she goes on to talk a little bit about the service that they attended. She says, thank you so much for sharing. As a nurse and now as a high school teacher, I see girls like this all the time. The story has now been shared lots of times with many of my friends, and we must not only pray for these families, but we must be more diligent in watching the fragility of our students. One of our teachers stopped a similar incident last spring. He simply picked up on a difference in one of his students. He notified the parent and the social worker, and they all later found out she'd actually been planning suicide that night. God help us all that we interact more proactively with kids on an everyday basis. So that's my charge to each and every one of us today. We have got to be engaging intentionally. You may feel like it is awkward to get up in their business. You might feel like it is awkward to say, I see some changes in you. You seem to be disappearing. You seem sad. Who are your friends and what are you guys doing? It may feel a little bit intrusive, but it could also be life-saving. And so we have got to get off the sidelines of this conversation, and we have got to communicate to kids that they not only belong, but they matter, that life is precious, that it is a gift from God, that they are highly valued, that in all the world, in all of creation, there will never be, there never has been, and there never will be another person with exactly the same combination of attributes as your precious child or grandchild or that neighbor kid down the street. The Wall Street Journal actually posted an essay on the 15th of September entitled, Children Need Close Pals, Not Popularity. And so if you need a little research to equip and empower you in these conversations, listen to this. This is a really good resource to use in a conversation with your preteen kids who think that popularity and iPhones and all those things are, you know, what they need. Jennifer Wallace leads off the article, again, in the Wall Street Journal, Children Need Close Pals, Not Popularity, with this. Chasing after popularity can be stressful for children and for their parents. A growing body of research suggests they should give a different focus to their social energies, having intimate friendships. Intimate friendships actually produce in kids higher self-esteem and lower levels of anxiety and depression. Friendship is based on trust and support, and therefore we get what we give. And so if you want to be popular, you're probably doing things that are tearing other people down at some level, which does not leave you as a trustworthy person who people view as supportive, and therefore you have no friends. All right, so here's a quote for you from Cynthia Erdley, a professor of psychology at the University of Maine. Having one good friend is enough to protect against loneliness and to help bolster self-esteem and academic engagement. Dr. Erdley says that one reason for the boost may be because, quote, students who feel a sense of belonging, there's that word again, don't have to worry as much about what's going on socially in their classroom. All right, so I just wanted to give a quick shout out to my best friend from high school and my best friend still today. Her name is Jessica. Hey, Jessica, I am pretty sure that you gave me a sense of belonging in the face of my dad's death when we were sophomores in high school. And I'm pretty sure that you have been the person who has kept my esteem high throughout the years. So thank you, my friend. Hey, everybody listening, let's be encouraging young people in their friendships. Let's help them find and foster and forge really good, deep, intimate friendships. Just to bless them, man. All right, friends, that's the Reconnect. That's all we got time for today. Visit me online at reconnectwithcarmen.com. Sign up for the podcast. Donate to the ministry. Share today's show with someone new. And I should say again, pre-order the book. All right, thanks. Have a great day and God bless.
The Reconnect is brought to you by the Presbyterian Lay Committee. To continue the conversation and become part of the Reconnect community, visit reconnectwithcarmen.com.